Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 4, Episode 2, titled Well Enough Alone. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
I thought this episode, though, I watched this episode 3.5 times because the fourth one was, I was, you know, doing all my notes and research in the background. There's a lot going on. This is... Mm-hmm. You know, getting back into Westworld form, which means you notice everything and you don't take anything for granted. You always remember that this could be in a different timeline, could be in a different plane of reality. The person speaking words could be someone completely different. They're really pointing and hinting at some big things going on that I'm interested in. You know, primarily the mystery is, you know, what is the nature of Christine's reality? You know, why, what, how, what, and why are the, is the man in black doing the things he's doing for the behest of Shaloris? What's Shaloris's overall plan for humanity? What's up with the flies and the black goo? Like, this early stage Westworld, and I think it's done about as well as you can do it. I'll re-register my reluctance and skepticism to go back into a Westworld, a 1920s temperance, whatever you want to call it. Especially since it seems like everyone's got their eyes open about what they're doing. Like, Maeve and Caleb know exactly what they're walking into. William is obviously going to know that they're there. It feels like I don't know what the point of doing that is, but, you know, I'm content to see what next week has in store, because it looks like we're going to get back to Bernard, which is another thing I'm super interested in. So yeah. I'm digging it. How about you?
Yeah, I think this episode has one of the best scenes I can remember in Westworld, with that man in black playing golf scene. It's an extremely well-written scene. And I was thrilled watching it for the third time, even. I guess I have to recalibrate again on this show, because I was totally wrong about William being dead at the end of last season. Even though you see his throat cut, even though you see him slump to the floor, at this point, there is no death I will believe on this show, period. None. Because humans can be both physically preserved in cryogenic states. Humans can be duplicated and copied as a host. Humans can be recorded, their brain patterns, and put into a host as a human. There is no possible death on this show, is my new calibration. So every time someone, you know, slumps over on screen, I'm going to laugh. Like, Anastasia, not dead. Not fucking dead.
Even if you disintegrate someone at the atomic level and have a scientist there with an electron fucking scanning microscope saying, yep, they got disintegrated. Mm-hmm. All a host has to do is think about the human long enough and develop a long enough term program of fidelity, and you can bring them back in some fashion. So, yes, there is nothing that can be fatal to a host or human, which, you know, has us going back to, like, even is Dolores dead? Is Christine a tortured version of Dolores that's, you know, they're trying to tease out some aspect of humanity for it?
They essentially did disintegrate her. They mentally disintegrated her last season.
And told us they did.
I still don't believe it. I still will not believe it. Which, you know, removes a lot of the stakes in some ways. But this show is not necessarily about individual stakes. It's about the stakes of a species.
Exactly.
Or two species, really.
Right. So that's the thing. It's like, you're still not... Because, like, that... the more I think about it, the more this is a restriction around the filmmakers than it is a liberty, because yes, they have all these freedom to do so many more things that are not in something that's more tightly based on current reality, but they still have to tell a fucking story that's satisfying and makes people enjoy watching it. So like, yes, they can do literally anything and they can lie to us and they can play all these tricks. But at the end of the day, they'd still have to tell a satisfying story with a beginning, a middle, and ending that resonates emotional. So like, I feel like this type of this type of crazy technology is almost more limiting than it is liberating, because there's so many pitfalls you can step in and there's so many off ramps for the audience to be like, nah, fuck this.
It's like telling a time travel story.
And, you know, like time travel stories, or if you're a science fiction fan, can be some of the best, most engaging stuff, or can be the worst shit you've ever seen. And it's all based on, you know, whether the storyteller is telling it to cut corners or telling something deliberately that you can only do with all of these tools at their disposal. So I, you know, I thought season three was a nice correction from season two. I think season four, the first two episodes we've seen, has been a nice building on the potential of season three. And I'm kind of like, my faith is slowly being restored in the Joy Nolan team up here.
Yeah, well, part of that is I feel like they're playing straight with us, except for one very specific part of the story, right? Yes, we don't know exactly what Shaloris' plan is and all that, but I feel like we're grounded in a time and a place, and I don't think they're fucking with us too much there. The only place that they are, and they're telling us that they are, is with Christina. So, you know, I can kind of compartmentalize a little bit and say, all right, this is the part of the show that is a little more grounded and a little more real, and this is the part of the show where I have to think in crazy circular theories. And that's been a little bit freeing too, because boy, they have not done that in previous seasons. In previous seasons, everything has been up in the air as far as whether it's a single timeline, whether it's a simulation, all that stuff. I'm happy to just have one part of the show that feels like that, but we'll see. I could be totally wrong about that. Like you mentioned, no Bernard or Stubbs yet. I'm kind of surprised we're two episodes in and we haven't got back to them at all. But it looks like next episode will be the one where we do. So I'm excited to see that. And then another thing I was surprised to not see in this episode is a continuation of the Teddy reveal. We just kind of totally go away from that for the whole episode. Which, I guess, how slow are they going to play this for the audience?
Well, yeah.
Is this going to be the full season where like Teddy comes in at the very end and says like, Christina, you're in a crazy, I don't know, pseudo world and we got to get you out? Or is it going to be like episode three, here he comes to interact with her?
Man, I don't know, because it feels like the reason they are pumping the brakes on the Teddy wagon is because, well, I guess narratively doesn't make sense because, you know, she hasn't putting herself in any danger. So why would, you know, Teddy man come save the day? But also, I think that like if Teddy comes and has a lengthy or any kind of conversation with Christina, the game's going to be up. Like, we're going to know exactly the nature of her reality, exactly where she's is, where to, like, all those are important clues that they want to keep from us. So I think it's more of like, you know, this is an 8-episode run. This is going to like pivot. This is going to be something that they kind of reveal when we go from act one to act two. This is probably going to be somewhere in the third or fourth episode. That's my guess. I don't think it's going to be end of season because I don't know why you introduce him so early if you're going to have him be submarine throughout the whole season. He's not that, you know, it's not like, right. I mean, people are happy to see Teddy back, but it's not like, you know, he was ever a main major character that people are going to be like, well, I wasn't going to watch this show. But I guess if Cyclops is back, I'm in, you know. I don't think it's that kind of draw. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, definitely not. William certainly is that draw. And then I won't say which scene. Maybe you can try and guess which scene I'm talking about. But this episode had in that golf scene, one of the best scenes I've seen at Westworld in a long time. And then it has another scene, which I view as largely as ridiculous and pointless, but We'll see. We'll talk about it
in
when
the
we
golf
get
there. Scene. Interesting.
No. The golf scene is excellent. There's another scene that is like the mirror image of that, which is just pointless, just useless, and pretty bad writing, in my opinion. But
interesting. I'm curious to see which one that is.
Yeah. All right. Maybe we should get into the recap.
Before you do, I told everybody that I'd read My Father's Dragon. And it turns out I did read My Father's Dragon. This is the book that Caleb was reading to his child in the last episode. It's a book from the 50s by Ruth Stiles Gannett. It's about 30 pages long. It's illustrated. It's available for a buck on Kindle or just widely available. If you just search for My Father's Dragon by the author's name, tons and tons of like universities and stuff have free online copies of it. Not sure if it's because it's public domain or I honestly don't know what the deal is, but I read it. And it's clearly thematically tied to the show. And I'm going to kind of like give people the breadcrumbs they need if they want to do some theory crafting. And I might have some stabs on what it means myself. But the book is about a boy who's recounting to, I think, his child or to somebody about their father's adventures on this wild island. It starts with this kind-hearted boy who finds a starving, cold, wet alley cat and brings him home and feeds it. And his mother throws a fit that if you do this to one cat, you're going to do it to all the cats. And she throws the cat out and the kid runs away out of pique that his mother's tyranny. And to repay him for his kindness, the cat tells him because the boy's dream is to fly. And it's in the 50s, and actually this is in the turn of the century. I don't think airplanes have been invented yet. And the cat's like, well, you know, I know this island where they have a baby dragon tied up. They're using him as a ferry to get across this river, and if you go and free him, he might give you a ride. The reason this baby dragon is imprisoned is because there's this island called Wild Island attached to this other island called Tangerina, where the humans live, with a narrow stone bridge. And this wild island is cut in half by a giant river. And the animals were vexed for years and years over the commute that they had to do. Since the island's bisected by this river, or nearly bisected, they have to walk all the way north and around the river and then go south to get where they want to go. Or they got to walk all, you know, vice versa to get home. And it caused a bunch of delays. And the river was full of these, I think, 17 crocodiles who are kind of like bastards and always hungry. So it's this vexing thing, not something you need for survival, but just an inconvenience. And one day a baby dragon crash lands on the island and they quickly grab it and they tie a rope around its neck. And now this baby dragon is forced in perpetuity to ferry animals from across one side of the island to the other. So the boy hears about this and he books a steamer to Tangerina. And he packs a whole bunch of stuff, and it's he packs like six. They go through. He packs six spy glasses or magnifying glasses, 17 cotton candy lollipops, a hairbrush and a hair comb, like all and every one of these items is going to have a just so application later on in the story. He sneaks across the land bridge from Tangerina to Wild Island, and he starts having adventures. He's trying to get to the baby dragon. There are various factions of animals. I will call them the ruling animals, the lions, the tigers, the lionesses, the gorillas, who are physically strong and imposing. And they kind of like impose their will on the island. There are this underclass of animals represented by the turtles, boars, mice, and chimps that exist by essentially currying favor. They spy on the island and keep the people on top apprised of what's going on. The chimps groom the gorilla, et cetera, et cetera. And then you got the alligators who are kind of like their own little faction. The boy is met by all of the ruling animals, and they all want to eat him and kill him. And he all puts them off by appealing to some greed or vanity. Like the tigers love bubblegum above all else. And he says that I've got a special bubblegum that if you chew it enough, it turns green. You can plant it and it turns into infinite bubblegum. So the tigers start chewing the gum and they lose track of the little boy. a lion's mother is going to come visit him, and he's got his mane all tangled up and matted, and he doesn't know what to do, but he's going to eat this little boy. But the little boy says, I've got something in my knapsack. It's so on and so forth. Every single one, he's got the exact amount that he needs to distract these ruling classes from what they're doing so he can pursue his objective, which is eventually he finds the baby dragon. And with a grand adventure, involves all the different animals, crosses the river, and is able to free the dragon, and he flies off happily. And that's where the story ends. To me, it's obvious some of the thematic things they're going for. We've got ruling people who have competing interests and desires and motivations, and you can pit them against each other. It's got a singular human that is focused on freeing another being from bondage and torment. You have another class of animals just kind of going along the system to, you know, because it's a convenience for them, this baby dragon flying them around. But I guess if this has any predictive value, we're going to have to look for those ruling elements, you know, letting their selfish needs and desires getting in the way of preventing something from happening. Yeah. And you're going to have to see a singular person freeing some being from torment. I guess my question is this something that's only valid looking back? Like, did Nolan and Joy choose this story because it thematically fits the events of the previous season, or does it actually have predictive value? And for example, sure. Caleb is going to free some being, you know, again. Do you have any, after I've said all that, do you have any thoughts on which direction you'd lean?
I don't know, because there are a couple of parallels you could draw. I mean, if Teddy is here to kind of free Christina from her bonds, she could be the dragon. He could be the human boy. Then there's, of course, like, what is Shaloris' plan? Is she trying to free the host from the human bonds and take them from, you know, the sublime, the wild island, perhaps, into the real world? I don't know. I don't know. It'll definitely come into clearer focus as we get more into this season. But yeah, I'd be surprised if it doesn't have any relation to this season.
And the interesting, most interesting faction are the alligators, because they are kind of apex predators, and they'll eat anybody they can. But they don't have a vested interest in maintaining the ferry system, because of anything that is a detriment to them. Before, animals might try to cross the river for convenience and they can eat them. But now, like, as long as a baby dragon's there, no one's going to do that. So they're kind of like their own. And to me, it's like maps. I'm not sure who's the crocodiles and who are the apex predators, but this neatly maps on like Caleb and Maeve's faction, and then Shaloris and the Man in Black's faction. And then I think your Teddy Christina is a pretty good little boy, baby dragon analogy. That maybe he's going to come in and try to save her while the other groups are battling for supremacy. And then that will set up the events of season 5. I don't know.
We really don't know. Like I said, Teddy's not in this one, so we don't know what he's doing here, but could be.
Anyway, keep your eyes peeled for these parallels. It could. I don't really have a dog in a fight about whether this is something that's going forward, predictive value, or is just thematic. But I read the book. There it is. You can read it too. Nice. It's 30 pages. Takes you about an hour. If you really study the pictures. Okay. There you go.
Illustrated. All right. Nice.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Okay, let's get into the recap now.
All right.
We start off with Clementine walking through an open-air market, and William is waiting for her at home. He asks where Maeve is and then kills her when she won't say.
Yes. I mean, I assume he's looking for Maeve, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he says as much.
Okay.
He starts off being vague, like, where is she? And then your master. And then finally he says, where's Maeve? So, yeah. Specifically looking for Maeve.
Why? Because
kill her, I assume. He wants her dead.
It seems like he has a line on her, though. Or I guess, like... We'll wait till we get to the senator and his wife scene to delve into that, because I guess I got a question about like what order are these scenes in. Are there more than one man in black happening? Because I was a little confused on how that stuff all connected together.
Yeah, and I don't know if he does. So we find out later in this episode that he's, you know, slit Clementine's throat but brought her back, and now she's working for Chaloris. I assume he might want to do the same thing with Maeve at some point. Bring her over.
I also wonder
side.
How she was discovered. Like, what gives, like, Maeve let off some kind of EMP pulse. Fair enough. What the hell did Clementine do? Buy the wrong avocado?
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to the wrong street vendor. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
How did they find Jason Bourne in the second movie? Third? Fourth? I don't know. Whichever movie that was. Anyway, Maeve and Caleb drive and chat about the lives they had during their time apart. There's a lot of vague discussion here, you know, but there's also stuff about is Maeve actually happy being alone, or is she just saying that? I have that question first.
I don't know. The title of this episode is Well Enough Alone, which... could you be used two different ways? Like, it could be described Maeve being well enough alone, but also it's like, you know, a lot of times you're cautioned to leave well enough alone.
Yeah.
That if you fuck with well enough, trying to get it to perfect, it can turn into dog shit. either way, neither of this is like, it's not saying that she's doing well or it's perfection. It's just she's kind of like muddling along. Mm-hmm. I got to think that she's lonely. I got to think that she misses her daughter, that she wants to somehow get back. But that's the thing. Like, we are fighting with both hands rhetorically tied behind our theory crafting body here, because there's a whole sequence of events they allude to with the robot war, the lighthouse, these pivotal things that happen that could have distracted her or made her think that she needs to wait a good long while to try to liberate her daughter. Because, like, yeah, like, Maeve is a woman on a mission, has always been defined thus, to try to get to her daughter and get her to safety. And she's just going to take 7 years and cool her heels in a cabin in fucking rural Alaska or something. It doesn't make sense. The only way it can make sense is if we understood what happened at the lighthouse and during the robot war. So,
yeah,
hard to say. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I lead to, is like, yeah, she's kind of just saying this. She's always flippant with her comments, right? She's never actually saying to people what's on her mind. I don't know the relationship she has with Caleb, though it was clearly close at one point. Has that changed over the 7 years where they haven't seen each other? There seems a little bit of trepidation in the conversations to talk about certain events, what happened after mm-hmm. the lighthouse. So I don't
that's
know.
Just because
I
they don't want us to hear them.
I mean, that's too.
Like, the viewers are watching. They might learn something. We're not supposed to talk about this in episode five, Caleb.
The other thing I couldn't help but notice in this scene is, why did they have Maeve drink and drive? I think that's pretty uncouth from just an imagery perspective and a glorification perspective, because she ain't doing it because she's living a terrible life, right? She's just doing it because that's something cool and fun for her to do. But, like, is it thematically trying to tie them to what we know comes at the end of this episode with this temperance park?
Yeah, that feels pretty ham-fisted. Feels pretty mm-hmm. bacon gauntlety, you know.
But they do it later in the episode, too, where she orders him a Sazerac and then says easy on the absinthe because he's a featherweight with the drink. And I'm like,
right.
After I've seen this episode a couple times, I'm thinking, okay, they only really put that in there to set something up in Temperance, right?
That's what I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right. But the reason, I guess the only reason I'd say you're wrong is because, again, as I said, that feels very, you know, doing something just for the sake of doing. And a weird, like you said, you know, drinking and driving, not cool. I feel the same way every time I see a person riding a motorcycle without a helmet, which is all the goddamn time on TV. Sure. I understand why they do it, but Jesus. But it's also one of those things where, like, I don't understand the nature of the host reality. This is something that I know we've complained about since season two, that, like, why does six shots to a torso not disable a flesh and blood body, but, like, blowing their kneecap off wood? You know, like, there are structural things the human body needs in their torso beyond just the mechanical soundness of a knee. When Maeve drains a whole bottle of wine on the way to the senator's house, can she just, like, dismiss that at will? Can she just choose not to be intoxicated, to respond to the intoxication levels? I don't know. I don't know what kills hosts. I don't know what inebriates them. But it does seem like, yes, this is thematic to the world they're going into, where alcohol is prohibited and something that only outlaws do.
Sure. And she has always been a bit of an outlaw.
She has been. Always been outlaw affiliated, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, they end up at the California senator's house. I don't know this guy's name. I know his wife's name, Anastasia, but his was lost on me.
Senator Host that's dead now.
You're right. They subdue the senator and kill his wife, both of whom are hosts. And Maeve has a little trouble controlling their motor functions in the heat of battle there. Then she interrogates the senator host. She sees his memory of William replacing them both and taking Anastasia to the barn with the livestock.
So, first of all, I thought this was a competently staged action scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Show had, I thought, struggled with that in the early phases of season two, three, and season two especially. I felt like we've had two or three good action scenes in the first two episodes, so it didn't make me, like, scratch my head or want to gouge my eyeballs out. So I'm starting to relax a little bit on that front. Second, I had a whole bunch of questions about how Maeve and Caleb navigated a complicated entrance to the opera house and, you know, the needle drop and find all those questions have been answered by the fact that Maeve can just scan this guy's memories and pull everything out of it.
Yes.
And he was aware because clearly they were talking about like they interrupt them getting ready to the opera. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the scene. So she's going to know everything he knows. Now I'm confused in the opposite direction by why so many things take Maeve by surprise. Uh-huh. Did the host senator only know he was going to an opera? Did he not know that there was going to be a train that takes him to the new Westworld and he was going to be the beta tester of that? Why does this surprise Maeve? Like, yeah. I've gone through the looking glass and I'm on the other side. I'm like, well, shit, this side doesn't make sense either.
You're right. I expect the, you know, the senator and his wife show up to the opera. It's completely empty. There's the gramophone playing on the stage there. They sit down and they listen to it because they didn't know about the door. They weren't right. The door wasn't meant for them. Like,
yeah, just like the maze. The maze. It's not meant for you. Well, that was weird. I don't know why Shaloris had us do that. I don't know why she sent the. But the other thing that's weird about these timelines and it makes me think that maybe there's some timey-wimey stuff going on here. As this show wants us, I want to know how much time elapsed between William buying the Hoover Dam, building Temperance World, and opening it. Because it seems like he's going around. They specifically mention that the senator's wife and him were attacked just a day or two before Maeve and Caleb got there and were just replaced. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the permission to go forward with his project. I don't know whether he was building the whole park without permission, and he was seeking to like for at the last minute to open to the public, and that's what he needed to do. But like,
yeah, there's a line in the golf scene where he's talking to the vice president, where he says the money's already been spent. You know,
yeah,
all we needed was your sign off or whatever.
So I guess I guess that makes sense that you would spend that money securing the knowledge that you can just replace anybody who wants to squawk about opening your park, and quash all that. Resistance, because this guy, his wife's sister died in one of the Westworld rampages of yesteryear. So she's like this whole family is diametrically opposed to Daedalus operating in another one of those parks. What does it mean when Maeve struggles to impose her will on another host?
The code she was expecting to be there wasn't quite there, or it was modified in some way. I mean, that's
but she was still able to brute force it. And what does it have to do with her saying freeze all motor functions? It seems like
I mean, that's just an effect for the audience to know what she's doing.
So we know what she's doing when she's sitting there grunting and straining at this guy. I thought that's interesting. Like she said, she mentions that William has upgraded his goons, but I mean, this is kind of like Neo and in Matrix Reloaded, where like the agents are upgraded and they're a little bit more of a challenge, but ultimately not much. Is this going to herald eventually an unbeatable host that she can't just mind control?
That's what I wonder. Like, could she, you know, walk in and mind control Shaloris? Yeah, probably
or
not.
Man in Black. But why? Yeah. Why not? Why couldn't she?
Right. I don't know.
Unless they're going to start walking around with Cerebro helmets on or something. Magneto helmets.
Has she like solved that puzzle now and every host that she encounters with those upgrades is going to be just as easily controlled, or is it going to be a struggle every time? Are they setting up a world in which she can't control the host in Temperance? Is that what they're trying to do?
Certainly not in mass. Like, you could do this onesie twosies, but if 15 of these guys came at you and you had to make this much effort on every one of them, they're going to cut you to ribbons. We'll probably get the answer to this sooner rather than later. Probably next episode. Because if I was Maeve, I'd just try it right off the bat. Like, as soon as you see a like, I'd have done it to Lily Simmons. Freeze all motor functions. You're trying to hit on my man. Freeze your motor functions. I would suppose they would use the same. Why wouldn't you use this upgraded henchman? Especially if my theory I mentioned on Instant Take is true, which is that... Shaloris is using Temperance to wholesale replace humanity. Like all the rich and powerful people that come there, they're going to afford the park. They're going to walk in as healthy, happy human adults, and they're going to walk out as healthy, happy host hybrids, or at the very least, flies buzzing in their head. but yeah, probably replaced as hosts.
Yeah, I feel like if you wanted to get a bunch of flies in a bunch of people's heads really fast, you would have reopened Westworld. Because there are a lot of flies in Westworld.
I'm sure there's a lot of flies in 1920s New York City or Atlantic City or whatever they're going to go Chicago, for. Chicago.
Fewer, certainly.
The senator's wife saying, "I just had this strangest dream." Is that a reference to her seeing herself? Is that a reference to her being flies in her head?
I think it's just a reference to her having encountered her own host doppelganger.
She did. So the other thing I got a question about is, oh wait, we haven't got there yet. We haven't gotten to the barn scene. Sorry.
No, not quite. Shaloris does mention that she is researching a new experiment, which she thinks Anastasia could be useful for. We'll see the aftermath of that here in a bit.
It's weird to say that it's research and experiment when, to my mind, if this is the fly stuff, we've already seen it used several times, which starts to make me think maybe Man in Black and Shaloris aren't working.
Well, this is a memory of the senator being replaced. So this did happen in the past.
But a day or two ago, not like weeks and months.
Right.
Because Maeve mentioned that my associate visited you just a few days ago.
Right.
So if they're going to try to jam several months or years in between that time, like, it's going to have to be some big ass reveal. Yeah.
Right. What useful experiment could you do that a day later produces results that you can roll into production?
Especially since you've already, like, that's what I say. Like that Hoover Dam thing. Because I think that's connected to the new park. They're driving.
I think so.
They're driving east, or riding east from LA into the desert. They've got that big source of free power with all the computer mainframe power. They bought up all the land around it too, which is, they just wanted the dam. They didn't need to do that.
Right.
So like that had to happen years ago, and they were using the flies.
Maybe. I've got an alternate theory that maybe we can talk about when we get there. But
oh yeah,
it's possible it needed to happen a long time ago, but it's also possible it just happened.
That's true. I guess if you didn't need permits and you didn't need approval and you just wanted to build shit and you had an infinite amount of money, you could make shit happen pretty quick.
Or not. It doesn't necessarily have to be that they put the park there, the Temperance park.
Yeah.
They might be using that for something else, and Temperance is just nearby. They're recreating like several locations, but I can talk more about that later.
I do think the reason he bought up all that land around it though is to host the park. I'm not saying Temperance is in the Hoover Dam. I'm saying that the Hoover Dam is like the nerve center for everything he's doing out there, including Temperance, which is physically connected to the properties that is in, that also hold the Hoover Dam.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can just go into it now, because like in the trailer, you can see a scene at the Hoover Dam where there's this big rip in the fabric of the universe.
Yeah,
right?
And the sublime is leaking into reality.
Kind of leaking out. Yeah. I wonder if the land that they're buying up around there is not for like the host from the sublime to come out and have a city to live in of their own. So there wouldn't necessarily need to be development on it yet, but the Westworld the Temperance stuff is happening nearby, and that the land that they've been buying is reserved for the host from the sublime.
So if that's the plan, to be clear, Shaloris would have to decrypt what's in there to get access to the sublime.
Right.
And I also don't know, because like would she count that as her children? I guess they are.
I think so.
They're literally like, they're all children of Shaloris, or they're all children of Dolores, and Shaloris is Dolores. Yeah, I guess that would, because I was thinking, well, that can't be, because to me, her creating her own children would be a completely new race of hosts that's based on her code, you know, that's now different from Dolores's. But I guess not. If they're all kind of loosely her and they're all already her children, maybe she's talking about the ones in the sublime. But she doesn't have the key for that yet.
Right.
So that might give us a hint for what's going on with Christine.
Uh-huh.
Christina. Keep on wanting to mess that up.
Chrissy.
Yeah, here we go. Christoris.
Sure. Let's move on to Jim Navarro, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Counterterrorism. Boy, that title's a mouthful. Going to Delos HQ, where Clementine denies him a meeting with their CEO. And of course, we know the CEO is Chloris. But he doesn't know that.
I like Clementine's new look, like with her hair all gathered up and close to her head. She has a ridiculously long neck, and it's very praying mantis-like. She's got these huge eyes and this almond-shaped head on this giant stalk, and she's kind of like and especially when she right before she slaughters the Secret Service agents, I just thought, like, man, this looks so much like a praying mantis or some kind of sticked insect. It's very unnerving.
Oh yeah, her whole mannerism here. Her whole manner is just like alien, cyborg, insect, something. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's scary. She's been one of the more terrifying first minion of, I guess, Dolores and Maeve, and now of the Man in Black. But like I said, with the hair up, it's very alien, very, very menacing.
I had a hard time buying that not having an appointment stops a guy who claims he has the full backing of the U.S. government.
But does he have a search warrant and or appointment? Because if not, get the fuck out.
If not, then he doesn't have the full weight of the U.S. government behind him, I would argue. And so his statement is false. But
we're supposed to say that there's limits on the federal government's power. And they can't just boss us private citizens around.
Uh-huh.
You know, they gotta make a show of like going to a court and getting the... Yeah. But
well, they can go to a secret court. I mean, come on, you can go.
Yeah,
to
go to FISA,
right?
Where 99.99999% of the warrants get approved.
Yeah,
that's an airtight system. I'm sure it's because they only bring search warrants that are completely I's dotted and T's crossed. That's why the insane success rate of these warrants is. It's not because they're just rubber stamped.
And he knows that. You know, it's going to be a whole hassle later, like 5 years down the line when they submit a FOIA request and it eventually comes out. He didn't dot all his I's and cross his T's. He just doesn't want the paperwork. That's what it is.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Terrified of paperwork, this guy. Anyway, Caleb, Maeve, and Maeve find Anastasia in the barn playing with the entrails of the horses she's killed. Pretty grotesque scene. She tells them they have an invitation to the opera and then attacks them, so they're forced to kill her.
Yeah. Did you know, do you know anything about Don Giovanni, the opera?
I didn't, but I looked it up on Wikipedia briefly. I did not read the full synopsis, but I found out that according to Wikipedia, it's pretty thematically relevant. I saw a line that said, Don Giovanni, a young, arrogant, and sexually promiscuous nobleman, abuses and outrages everyone else in the cast until he encounters something he cannot kill, beat up, dodge, or outwit. And that, to me, sounded just... That's humanity. That is humanity, right?
It particularly screams William, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't start out social or sexually promiscuous, but the very first time he got spurned about the nature of Dolores' reality, he turned into the Man in Black pretty quickly.
But I feel like on the larger scale here, this is the species. That they're dealing with.
But don't you think William is a stand-in for all of us?
In certain ways, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, like I said, all my objections over how Maeve and Caleb navigated all this tricky stuff is resolved. Now I have new questions, which is, why didn't Maeve know the whole truth? Did Chloris actually keep that from her acolytes? There's no reason to say that she couldn't have. It was just an odd choice. It's almost like you start getting into these like kind of weird, like, well, how did Chloris know that Maeve and Caleb would show up just then and there? And then you could go back like, well, she started sending out the goons, rounding her and Caleb up to put pressure on them so they would. But like, you're starting to get to Heath Ledger Joker's level of how the fuck did he know this alley was going to be the one, the helicopter? And it's like, and this is the first time we see the black blood bubbling out of the no longer what Maeve says is a no longer human being's head once she blew its head off.
Yeah, which strikes me as like the opposite of the host milk that we've been seeing in previous seasons.
This is true. It's literally the opposite.
Yeah.
Except there should be a solid if it's the true opposite, but you know, then it wouldn't flow.
It's human milk. Wait.
Human milk.
Yeah.
That's a thing. It doesn't look like this, but no, it's a thing. Sure. Sure. Growing boy. So growing boys need black goo.
There are questions here about what is this experiment being done on or by this woman. We know, like you said, the flies already work. Maeve claims she definitely wasn't a host. So what then? Is this a test of like how long can we preserve this effect? Like, because she's off the freaking reservation, man. She's lost her mind. She's killing her horses. She's playing with their guts. How long has she been in this state?
I think a day or two. Because number one, she's a human being. She would die. You know, although she got stabbed in the shoulder. She's playing around with these dead animals. There's flies buzzing everywhere. And I had a theory when I first saw this episode that this moving the livestock to the barn was code for the facility William was in. But that doesn't make sense with them leaving her there for days. Like, now I'm starting to think it's just a barn and they aren't actually warehousing a whole bunch of frozen humans.
I think the livestock line is more about Shaloris's feelings of humanity. Right. Like, these are animals. Yeah. But I don't know. We'll see.
Why did she have to attack Caleb? I didn't understand, you know.
Her work is done and she wants to do what the dude at the Hoover Dam did.
What was their work, though?
To tell them about the opera.
But she didn't have to because Maeve already knew.
Maeve already knew? Are you talking about from the memories of the host, Center? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, the show doesn't want us to think about that, right? The show isn't telling us, hey, she learned about this through the host mind meld.
Maybe Shaloris doesn't trust that Maeve wouldn't just come in there and blow everyone's head off. So she needs a human to formally put the. But that's the thing. It's like if that's what confused me about my first watch is that like if she's relying on this woman's information, I guess the opera and Don Giovanni
naming
presumably
the opera saying it's opening night. I think is enough to get you there. That's kind of where I was at after watching this for the third time.
But if it's like, public information, why isn't a shit ton of people at the opera waiting to get in?
Fair.
That's what I'm saying. There's something that's not hooked up, and I'm not sure if we're supposed to notice these inconsistencies, and that's supposed to clue us into the nature of the reality that we're dealing with, or this is just a little sloppy Joe. It could be either way, because this show, unfortunately, has been capable of both.
Is it because he got there early? Like they went straight there and the opera wasn't scheduled to start for another 6 hours or something. And so no one was there.
I don't know. When does the opera start at 2 a.m.?
Huh? It wasn't dark when they show up at the opera.
It wasn't? I thought it was evening time. Okay. Well, maybe that could be the answer right there.
Maybe. But how can they rely on them getting there at a certain time then, right? not just like encountering this person in this place, but at a specific time.
Yeah. And also, again, I guess the senator did not have the information. That the only way this makes sense of the senator did not know about Temperance. He did not know that they were going to the opera under cover of being invited to Temperance World. Because also it seems like Temperance is open to the public. They are doing a beta event. There are other humans that are you could have just invited him to that facility. I don't know. This stuff doesn't make sense. And like I said, I'm not sure if it's not adding up because it's intentional and these are breadcrumbs to follow or if it's just a little oversight.
Gotcha. All right. Dolores wakes up in her strange world. She's preoccupied with Peter's death the previous day. Her roommate tells her that, look, this guy's a mental case. He donated a bunch of money to Hope Center for Mental Health. And on her way into work, she hears a homeless man talking about the tower and then sees a bunch of dead birds and decides not to go to work.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people finding similarities between her conversations with her roommate and Caleb's conversations with his therapist last year. That they are on the surface, like taking their concerns seriously. But below the subtext is always, oh, don't think about it too hard or don't worry about it. Or, oh, I'm sure it's all got an easy explanation. Mm-hmm. We know, of course, Caleb, his reality is being manipulated by unseen forces. This is just like, I mean, obviously Christina right. is living in some kind of abstracted reality, whether it's a real world place like Temperance, whether it's a VR place. This is just yep. more evidences of their similarities there.
Yeah. And there's some specific stuff here that the homeless guy says about the tower, the song with no sound. It's killing them. He says he and the birds are the only ones that can hear it. And those birds, of course, end up dead on the ground at the end of the season.
And then this episode, we'll see how many birds are dead by the end of the season.
Yeah. All of the birds. Mm-hmm.
Nothing but flies now.
At the end of the scene is what I meant to say. You get this revolving door scene, which I thought was interesting from an audio perspective, because it's like this thrumming, mm-hmm. pulsating sound, like a signal that she's tuning into in that moment. I don't know. I mean, is this guy an NPC? Because she speaks to him in this scene, but he apparently doesn't hear her. And I don't know if that is telling us that he can't hear her or that he is just ignoring her because he's an NPC in this world that is like pushing her down a quest line, essentially.
It's tough to say. Also, people notice that on the more to your point, there is a bench with people talking on it. That she passes in both episode one and episode two, and at least two of those people are the exact same people.
Gotcha.
In the exact same position on the exact same bench. So the implication is
Christina.
Thank you, Christina. It seems like she's not the only one that's on a loop.
Yeah. No, it really feels, the more I watch this, that she is in some kind of video game-esque world that is looping again.
I ask you, why are you like all in on the simulation theory? Why can't this be in the real world?
I suppose it could be, but
do you know the reason I think it is?
It is in the real world?
Yeah, it's actually physically happening at a physical location.
Yeah, why?
It's based on two things. Number one, the fact that Christina drove off and found this relic that has, you know, this crazy connection to Peter. But the more stronger one is there's two scenes in the trailers where Shaloris is observing humans like dancing and doing things very much like Bernard and Ford supervising the hosts learning how to play their parts in Westworld. And yeah, I don't know why you would do that if you had a simulation. Why would you like be coming through and like visually inspecting all these people? You could just test their code.
I don't recall seeing those scenes. So
yeah
I mean, it's totally possible she's in a real world park, a lot like Westworld, that is also looping.
I guess the
reason I thought it might be a video game type scenario is because of the company she works for and what they do. But that's pretty thin.
Yeah, I think that's just I don't know. I there's some interesting theories about what is going on here that I want to wait until we get to the scene where her boss calls her on the road to talk about.
Yeah. Okay.
It seems like a lot of people are fixated on the virtual reality aspect of it. And I'm like, I'm not sure why this can't be physically happening in the real world. It could be in a very different time. This could be far in the future.
Sure.
Where, you know, like a lot of people speculated that the Earth has been kind of ruined and it kind of is shitty, and like just going back in the exact same way that like people are fascinated by going to Westworld. Mm-hmm. Ooh, look, wagons and steam locomotives and six guns and shit like that, right? You would be like in 2150 when the world is fucking flooded and New York City doesn't exist, like going back to a version of Manhattan would just be quaint and exciting.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've seen those theories, and I kind of like those, too.
All right, we'll talk more about them here in a bit.
Yeah. So the vice president pays a visit to William on the golf course to convince him not to go through with whatever he's planning. We end up knowing exactly what that is at the end. After the world's most ominous series of golf shots, William kills the vice president, and Clem kills his security. This is a great scene. This is excellent storytelling, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot less clumsy than Westworld can be at times. Because Westworld, you know, it's a well-made show, but the story it's telling sometimes necessitates a lot of exposition. Mm-hmm. And this is the opposite of that. And so when they can get these moments of just pure visual storytelling, of show don't tell, I really appreciate them.
Yeah. I even thought that it was clever, the guy, because this guy, I think, is supposed to obviously think that the vice president's a Democrat or some sort of liberal, mm-hmm. and he's hitting inappropriately on Clementine, and he's calling the man in black a fucking psycho, damaged goods, to which he's like, I don't know how your base would feel about that kind of language, right. Seeing as how I'm neurodivergent, which is literally true. I know we talked about this on instant talk portion that the only club members get, but that's it's certainly a wry way of observing it from a host. But it's true. You know, we have bags of meat to hold our thoughts, and he has a little shiny marble.
Yeah. So and they're just taking digs at each other. You know, he's taking shots at him for the hell of it. Honestly.
Yeah.
Because he could kill him at any time and replace him. There's no need to have this conversation, but he is just enjoying the moment.
They like it. Just the same way that William liked to taunt Teddy back in the Westworld days, the new man in black is liking, and Shaloris too, likes to play with their prey. Mm-hmm. So they've learned a lot from humanity, it turns out.
Yeah, I like that they've kept that aspect of William's personality. You know, all of the hosts aren't the same, because this is one of the few hosts that I feel is not some version of Dolores, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so. I also really thought it was cool, and I noticed this on my third watch, that when William had the, you know, man in black hat, and his eyes are shrouded in darkness throughout the whole scene, but they lit Ed Harris's, I don't know what they did, but his eyes kind of sparkle silver in reflected light. Hmm. And it's very similar to the original Yul Brynner man in black from Westworld. You know, when he was using his targeting vision, his eyes would turn kind of like that silvery, reflect this weird silvery light. I think they're intentionally trying to evoke that stuff. And I don't think it matters to the plot. I just thought it was really fucking cool.
Uh-huh. All right. Anything else about this scene? Should we move on?
I mean, the only thing is, like, it's because we missed this in the instant take, that this is the vice president. It's not the president.
Yeah.
So that is indicating that the host will have more of a soft power, or it could indicate that the hosts are going to murder the president and then the vice president become the president, or they could murder the president and replace him with a host.
Or they already
we'll
have.
We'll see.
And or they just already want the have. Vice president too.
Vice president was the lone human member of the entire cabinet.
Sure.
And he just got yoinked. Because replace him. That's it. They didn't just kill him, because later we hear the vice president's all hot to get on board of the Delos initiative. And it's vexing the deputy attorney general for counterterrorism, etc. Mm-hmm.
All right. Maeve and Caleb arrive at the Angelus Arts Pavilion, where they find themselves the only attendees of that evening's opera. They follow the music to an elevator that takes them down to a lounge. And in the lounge, they talk sort of around what happened at the lighthouse and afterward, and then the room starts to move and they find themselves on a train.
Yeah, that's what happens.
So much about the scene and the setup of it already.
It's kind of, I thought it's cute that they ordered each other's drinks. It'd be kind of like, again, I made the analogy. This is like Obi-Wan and Anakin in the third prequel talking about what good friends they were, you know, and we didn't see any of it, but they're talking about all these events. Cause like Maeve and Caleb up until the final moments of the finale of last season were kind of antagonists.
Yeah.
And Dolores' sacrifice brought them together and gave them this new hope. But they apparently went on a damn near close to year-long war against the robots. And these are where Caleb has gotten his men, you know, his acolytes from. Mm-hmm. They're not going to tell us about any of that. We're going to get one little flashback of Caleb apparently dying. They're going to make this oblique reference to the lighthouse and how, you know, his wife says that the war that was ever over for him, like yeah, we just it's frustrating not knowing the full picture here.
It is. We'll eventually get it, but because yeah. It seems too important, right? Like the idea that you would have to destroy another copy of a machine that we thought there were only two copies of seems so important that they can't not tell that story.
Yeah.
But when they'll get around to it, who knows?
I thought it was interesting that Maeve, when Caleb's observing that it's not an easy, war's not an easy thing to put behind you, and Maeve observes that she's an infinitely adaptable machine, that's why she's not bothered by it. Usually when you hear the words infinitely adaptable machine, people are talking about humanity, humans, right. Like that, yeah. We are that thing. I just thought that was an interesting choice of words for her to make there.
Yeah, no, the show has been kind of hinting around the idea that hosts might be more adaptable, might have free will, whereas humanity does not, right?
We're just fooling ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, so. Like the ones, because like obviously everyone can adapt to everything. There's people that lose their mind and go crazy and drop out of society. Yeah. Perhaps the hosts have the ability to not do that, to truly adapt to anything given enough time and circumstance. Although we've certainly seen our share of crazy ass hosts.
Oh yeah, for sure. Usually it's when you try and put a human into one, but yeah, there are also crazy hosts out there. Were you surprised by the door leading to the lounge, leading to the train, leading to Temperance? Because in the post-episode like breakdown that they do mm-hmm. on HBO, they were talking about how this was a difficult task for them not to just give away the fact that they were going to do a one-to-one here of like door that leads to train that leads to park too soon. And I felt when I was watching it that
yes.
It completely took me by surprise because I didn't think they would do it again. Not that I wasn't connecting dots, but I was like, okay, are they really going to go back to a park now that they're in the real world? That seems both like a bad idea and very implausible. But
no, I actually slumped a little bit when they go beneath the stage and it's just the obviously a Westworld door.
Right.
And like, I guess the train took me by surprise, but I'm kind of with you. It's like, I don't think the train needed to be there. It could have just been the door opens and here's Temperance World. Like, I don't know. They do have a fetish on this show to do shot per shot remakes and reimaginings of things.
Sure.
Even when it doesn't necessarily make sense. You know, a lot of people pointed out that like Lily Simmons openly flirting with this woman's husband. I don't know. In the far future, maybe everyone that goes to Westworld is down the fuck robots and have threesomes and all kinds of crazy shit. But like that would be a wild thing to just, you know, take a flyer on.
I wonder if it happened with, do you remember that family that Dolores encounters when she's painting?
Yeah.
I wonder if it happened with them.
You know, right. The whole like, yeah, the kids are there and everything. And Tallulah Riley's like, you know, dicking down the husband with her eyes.
Would you like me to help you get dressed and yeah. Right in front of his daughter? Yeah.
Is there anything else I can accommodate for you?
Right.
Some large bulky carry-ons for which you'd like for me to store and some. Yeah, it's wild. But they wanted to almost shot per shot recreate the scene of William coming to Westworld for the first time, which he was a young single guy, and that would be entirely appropriate, mm-hmm. I guess. Even though he had a fiance and all that kind of shit, as a bachelor party thing, it's a lot more than yeah, when you're there with your wife. But again, I don't know. Maybe open relationships are a lot more common in the mid 21st century, the late 21st century, than they are right now.
Could be. Anything more on that scene, or
I don't think so.
Let's move on. All right, Charlotte reveals herself to Jim Navarro and then implants him with a mind control fly.
Yep, this is the plot. It's not practical to replace you one at a time through these little stupid games we play.
The most interesting part of this to me is where she says, I want my people to be able to grow and find their own identity. Because
mm-hmm.
that's not just an implausibility thing. That's like an ideological thing that she's in on here. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, she definitely says like later to the man in black, like, I'm prepping your world for my children.
And she tells the Navarro here, I have plans for your kind.
Uh-huh.
Before she pumps his eyeballs full of flies, which a deeply uncomfortable scene. I don't know why the AG just keeps his eyes open and lets it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you get in your ear holes, that's on them, because your ear holes don't have flaps that you can close. You can manually retract, right? But yeah. If you just got eyes crawl, you got flies crawling your eyes, and your response is open my eyes wider. Just like, oh, just blink. Like, make Clementine hold your eyeballs open. Resist. Right. Rage against the dying of the light. Come on, Navarro. Thought you were a tough guy.
Nah, he's a lot of hot wind coming out of that guy.
He's a fly boot looking pussy, like the man in black said.
He doesn't even have the full backing of his eyelids, let alone the U.S. government.
A fucking Fitzgerald, this guy. He's hemming way up. Yeah.
Right? All right. Dolores accesses her previous story files on the road, and her boss calls to check up on her, but turns out it's fine that she called off work because she has a whole 4 sick days per year. I said this office is hell in the first episode. It's doubling down now. 4 sick days a year is a joke. She's got to be in some hellish simulation.
I bet over half the workforce in the United States doesn't even have 4 days of guaranteed sick day.
Guaranteed.
Like, if you're working hourly, if you're working part-time hourly, no fucking way. No shot do you have sick days.
No.
So it's like it's dystopian, but it's also more than our current I don't know, what's dystopia? We're just a topia. We haven't fully utopia. we're not utopia. We're haven't quite gone to dystopia. We're just
a topia. Is that
we're atopia. Antopia? Yeah. But yeah, it's I noticed that too, and I was like, well, it's depressing to think that like some people would love to have 4 days. You know, that they could not have to go in when they're sneezing and hacking and coughing. And
I mean, I'd love for those people to have 4 sick days so they can stay the hell away from me when they're sneezing and hacking and coughing. But
yeah, that'd be nice. Did you see any of the stuff where they zoomed in on that employee screen that that someone freeze framed and zoomed in on the employee screen that this guy was scrutinizing?
I saw a lot of talk about loops. Saw a lot of talk about potential host qualities here.
It's tough because, like, if you called Lee's file up in season 1 of Westworld, it would say that he's an employee, right? And he works in a narrative department, and there'd probably be information about what build of Westworld he's on and some basic analysis. But, mm-hmm. like, it's hard to not see that this looks a lot like a host analysis screen.
Yeah.
It could all be referring to the software that she's working on, and this is all, but like, there's a lot of things here, like, you know, continuity of her developing narrative, the structure with a loop connection depth. Mm-hmm. I think 31, it could be 001, yeah. Loop stability. You know, there's all these different things that are, but then there's also a menu that flies off that goes explicitly into the narrative department where it's looking at the thing that she's writing on Peter Myers, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it looks a lot like Christina is a host, which we've been screaming since the first episode. So
yeah, the show does love to play around with those, you know, double entendres of information, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people are trying to play games with their hurt because it shows their employee number, and they're trying to, because we know we saw like William's asset ID last year. There doesn't seem to be any commonality there, but we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Like I said, this is if people want to look at this image and play with it, theory craft and knock yourself out. I'm gonna wait and see what the show spins doles out for us.
So the other interesting thing about this scene, I guess, is the story of Peter, because she pulls up her previous story files that she has written and finds a story of a man named Peter who was depressed, felt different, started seeing things, imagining conspiracies, and then his wife left him. He lost his job. He blamed it on a girl who he became obsessed with. He stalked her, thought about killing her, and then he killed himself eventually. She wrote every detail of the story we've already seen in this world with a man named Peter. This also, of course, could apply to like a William, maybe some other people, who knows, but she definitely wrote Peter's story, or at least the file that says she did is there.
So the coolest theory that I saw about what's going on here is that they want the human data out of the Forge. Dolores has read every book in the Forge. I thought that they made that clear. I could be wrong, but I thought it was only a few. Or maybe they just want her to reveal one particular person. But they are getting her to write these stories, and they're all based on host data that was contained in the Forge. And they have gotten some vestige of Dolores, and they bootstrapped her into this reality/simulation. And by saying only think of the miserable thing, they're trying to get her to think of a particular tragic story so they can recreate either a particular person or a bunch of different people. Mm-hmm. They don't want her to write her own shit because that's stuff coming out of her own imagination. The stuff that's all misery and miserable is all the human data. And they're getting her to regurgitate this. And the fact that Peter had already existed and had a hospital wing dedicated. The people are speculating that he had visited Westworld in the past. They had that host data. They knew that happened to him. So they're, you know, I don't know why we're obsessed. Yeah. I don't know why we're fixated on Peter, but that just might be, you know, they can't control. They can't tell her to directly remember a particular human. They're just having her focus on the negative stuff so she can get all the human stories out there eventually.
Sure. Yeah, no, I like that theory a lot.
It's a way to get around not having the encryption key to that stuff. Mm-hmm. Or it's also a way that, like, if deep down in Christina, the encryption key is buried at some on sub level that she just doesn't have conscious access or memory to, it could be a way of, like, once they put enough pieces together, they can rebuild their encryption key as well.
Oh, yeah. Like, maybe they know, like, the base of it, but the there's a host in there that's, like, the salt for their key.
Data. Honestly, I don't know in detail how encryption keys work. I was just saying that, like, yeah, if you got enough of it together, then you could reconstruct it. But
yeah, no, we'll see.
I think that theory's got some legs because it neatly explains everything that we've seen so far.
All right, next up is Caleb and Maeve still traveling when they're approached and onboarded by their park host, Sophia. This is the scene that we've kind of talked a fair bit about already.
Mm-hmm.
And this will continue all the way to the end of the episode because we got a lot of other stuff to cover here.
It is kind of like there's a lot of things that are kind of insane here. Like, if the man in black knows that this is Maeve and Caleb and he wants them to come in, What is with them asking about the medical history and the mental illness? I was kind of curious about, like, why does that matter? Are they screening people for mental illnesses now?
Why don't Maeve and Caleb have an invitation? Why does she have to create that on the fly with this thumbprint scanner thing and pretend to be Mr. and Mrs. Morgan?
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't really check ID beyond the thumbprint, which isn't going to match what they expect to see. Because, like, we know this world has security because there's a whole episode last season about the difficulties and, like, the biometric markers and all the stuff that they check. And, like, I don't know. It's a weird thing because they're supposed to be here, but it feels like they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah. No, if we're expecting guests, I mean, at least alert the host, right? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything, like, personally, and I know we've, you know, talked about how weird it is to proposition somebody in front of their spouse here, but, like, is there a reason that Caleb doesn't respond in any way to these suggestive comments from Sophia?
What do you mean? Like, what would you expect him to do?
Say anything, something. Respond in any way instead of stare her like a brain dead fish. Like, he doesn't even register what she's saying, as far as I can tell.
I guess if you knew the kayfabe around the Westworld and Temperance World, and you knew that, like, this host has no choice, and this, like, I wonder if you would It's kind of like, I don't know, like when you're walking through a store and someone says, hey, are you an Insight customer? Do you want to sign up? And like, I don't even respond to those people anymore. I just walk past them, because if you say anything to them, it's an interaction that could hook you in. And like, this is even a couple more levels of contempt. So I imagine, like, if you knew everything about the whole Westworld, Temperance World, and this host reality, like, you'd have even one more layer of contempt above just, like, someone trying to sell you something, you know? Like, this is, like, why would he respond? You know, so he just shuts her down. If he responds to her advances, like, it's all pointless, right?
I guess, but it's not like he could just walk past her here.
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of in this place until she lets him into Temperance.
But they do. They also blow past, like, yeah. Like, they're... They don't have to wear hats. They're not. They're openly mm-hmm. flaunting the rules, it felt like.
I mean, they definitely don't want to wear the hats because they assume they're going to be recording everything they do, right? Yeah.
But like Lily Simmons wouldn't let a regular old person walk out by without a hat, right?
Probably not.
Yeah. Like the whole park is subsidized by your human data they're stealing from you.
Yeah.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, next up, Dolores arrives at the Hope Center for Mental Health, which has clearly been shut down for years. Inside, she discovers a plaque dedicating an entire wing of the facility to Peter Myers. And she calls a roommate to try and make sense of it, and then spies some drawings of the tower in her room. Why is this strange, Aaron? Can you explain to the audience why none of these facts add up? Because I feel like this could be a confusing scene for people. I know it was on my first watch.
It was, like I said, a lot of these scenes were very confusing. We have a weird impossibility here. This Peter that threw himself off the roof last episode is, and his newly released eulogy or his obituary mentions that he donated all this money to this Hope Center, to the hopefully found a mental health wing. She goes to this building who's been long abandoned. It's got like garbage and leaves and stuff strewn through it. It's not secured in any way, which is weird. She just walks in there and sees the plaque dedicated to this guy's donation. That's weird thing number one. The weird thing number two is the drawings of the tower that we saw in the trailer. Mm-hmm. And presumably the homeless guys and the birds are squawking about. Is hung up like children's drawings almost. What the fuck? This implies that she wrote off. Didn't that happen in the first two seasons of Westworld that Dolores literally got off her loop and started to leave the park?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
With William. So, like, I think that's what we've seen, that she's actually left her loop and has traveled off the park, and she's seeing the real world inspirations for the stories that she's told. Now, the other thing that leads me to another question, if they're trying to get her to do this, why the fuck would they create a virtual Peter who's going to kill himself? Like, it seems like they're trying to get her to go off the park.
Sure.
By giving her a mystery that she has to solve.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And whether that's Teddy's doing or her boss is doing, the company's doing, I don't know. But we'll find
Peter,
out.
Teddy set Peter up to jump off the roof. That's dark.
Possibly.
This is also in direct and I guess unless it's a Teddy thing, but this also seems to be in direct contradiction to the other theory, which is they're just wanting Christina to sit around and reimagine real people so that they can get access to this host data in the back door. Like, if you're going to do that, then you don't want her questioning the nature of reality and going off the park and solving Scooby-Doo mysteries. So it's like,
tons of breadcrumbs here. Like the homeless man is breadcrumb. Like, why allow him in a park where they're trying to control her experiences to get some information out of her? That would just upset the apple cart here. So
that's the thing. That's why it feels like we're dealing with three different layers of reality: the real world, Temperance, and wherever the fuck Christina's in. We're probably dealing with multiple timelines too. And these are all just clues, and we just have to keep in mind and keep on layering this, and eventually we'll figure it out.
Here's my bigger question. Does Dolores actually recognize this tower, or does she just see a strange drawing that could be a tower that she then, you know, free associates and connects with the homeless dude saying stuff about the tower?
You said,
I don't recall her ever.
You said Dolores,
the tower.
But I assume you mean Christina.
Yeah. The only Dolores analog we have so far this episode.
I didn't see that she'd recognize it. I thought it's like someone that's like, what the fuck is this? You know?
Yeah, really? There was more in that look to me than just a,
well, it could have been like
drawings
in
a mental hospital.
It's a tower. This homeless guy was raving about a tower. Uh-huh. It could be like, but I thought you meant like a shock of like, I know what this is. I didn't see that.
Okay.
Oh, you thought so?
That's what I was asking you about. Do you think that is the case?
No, she definitely noticed it. Cause I guess that's, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess now that I think about it, why would one weird drawing in a mental institution stick out over the other? But it's a tower. It's a clear tower. Her world is fixated on towers right now.
True. Yeah, see what she makes of it. There's one other weird thing in here, potentially. Dolores comes into this place and sees some construction workers and somebody talking to them and says to those people, just leave. And they immediately do. Is that an ability to control her environment a la Maeve and the hosts, or is that simply a coincidence?
It's wild. I don't know how it fits in neatly to any of the theories, because if she's that tuned in that she could, like she's season 3 Maeve and she can just order hosts about,
Yeah.
I don't know why construction workers working at a decommission would like listen to some, you know, woman that wanders in civilian clothes and tells them to get out. Yeah, it's like, I don't know. And do you have any ideas? Did you see anything?
No, I don't even think they hear her. They don't acknowledge hearing her. They just walk out at the exact moment she says that, which was very strange.
Yes. Yes. Almost like it's like she was is like something she wishes would happen and then it just happens. But there's, you know, is that a casual link? Is it a causal link?
I don't know. We'll see. All right. We go back to what I think is the worst scene of the entire episode. I think it's pointless. I think it's ridiculous. This is the scene I was talking about. Charlotte thaws out the human version of William for a round of exposition and then refreezes him. That's literally all she does, is talk about her plan to her victim and then refreeze him.
She injects something into him. That's the crucial part. I mean, we get a little bit of her like motivations in this scene. I don't know. It's pointless.
It seems pointless in the moment. Maybe it won't be eventually when we learn more about it. But
and also, she like, why did William keep coming into Westworld and fucking with Dolores and killing Teddy and shit like that? You know, like, I think they're trying to draw a line that she has become a lot more like the humans than she would, you know, because she's like into petty revenge and she's into this philosophy of to win, you got to have a loser, which is a direct quote. You know, that's what I think William said to Teddy in season one. I think
they need to give us a lot more insight into why she's doing the things she's doing. Otherwise, this, all of these expositional heavy scenes start to feel just like I'm the villain and I have to say evil things. Otherwise I'm not the villain. It's the mustache twirling, right? Of like any other really bad show you've seen.
Well, don't you think the William was doing that in the first two seasons? Like, I guess why, and if she's paralleling William's development, then of course she would go through a mustache twirling phase.
And in retrospect, all of that works and makes sense. I'm hoping they'll do the same here. But, you know, as it stands, I'm side-eyeing these scenes going, they really better make these more than just what they seem to be on the surface.
The her injecting something into him. Because the other thing is, like, we don't even know if this guy is the real human William. This could be just the latest instance of them trying to recreate a human William from, you know, scratch, that's eventually going to be passed a fidelity check 3,000 years in the dusty ass future.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta have something to latch onto in the show, and the show is trying to tell me that this is the real human William.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So I'm gonna say that this is a real human William until we find out something more.
What I'm saying is, like, the human, like, okay, because I think that if the real human William died and they recreated him perfectly to pass his fidelity check, that is also the real human William. Do you believe that or not?
Yeah, but I don't think that we've reached that. When we see a real human William being, you know, put into a host body and worked on as an experiment by his daughter, you know, the very much not his actual daughter, host version of his daughter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the end of season two, that is way far in the future. And but I don't feel like we are there.
The first step of a, you know, of a journey of 1,000 miles. Because again, she injects something in his neck, and it's clearly tied to experimentation she's doing to humans.
Well, to me, it was just like cryo stuff. Like, hey, we're going to freeze you in this chamber for a very long time. Here, inject this, and that'll enable your body to deteriorate or whatever.
You have to. So they got this whole fucking rig built up, and you still have to manually inject something into somebody, or it doesn't work. What the
That's
fuck?
How I read it, but.
I think it's black oil bee stings, baby.
You think so? They're doing something more to him?
Yeah, Fox Mulder, I want to believe. I think so, because like, I just think that's like, you got this fucking thing, he's hooked up to a million hoses, and it's like a carbon freezing system, and it's a petri, and you got to manually inject something, or he dies, doesn't survive the process. You're going to shoot him full of fucking antifreeze? What? No, I don't. You might be right.
You could be right.
I don't mean to make fun of you.
I legitimately don't know, and no one does at this point. So, like, sure, all theories are on the table. We'll see.
How do they cut off our paws? How do you keep humans? She's got plans for us. She wants to defang us. But, like,
I really feel like
over
the only
minds,
way to do that is it's to a weird, make us them.
It's weird to use the metaphor of like declawing or depawing something if you're literally remaking them into your image. I go back, and maybe it's because I don't want to give up on my theory, but I keep going back to last. I thought that Shaloris had a real change of heart and that she didn't want to exterminate all humans. She wanted to fix them. And maybe this is still like just her way of fixing us is like, you know, in the spay and neuter your pet kind of way. You fundamentally change something biological about them. But this feels more like she's using us for like a resource. You know, this isn't a peaceful coexistence in game. This is her mm-hmm. using us as a resource for the host's benefit, the same way that we use the hosts.
Yeah, I don't know, man. When I hear making sure they can never hurt us again, like I said in the instant take, the only way I can see that being a possibility is if we are them, because humans seem designed, like if you look at the Don Giovanni stuff, like humans seem designed to just consume and fight and kill everything in their path until, you know, they see themselves in it. So I don't know. It seems to me like she's trying to turn all of humanity into hosts eventually and, you know, kill. Of course, it's not feasible to do one by one, but you get a park where humans are voluntarily going and then you kill a bunch of them.
It's like a parallel path. You replace humans with hosts and then you also birth new hosts to have their own distinct identities and
exterminate humans in other ways too. So
Have them kill it. Yeah.
I don't know.
Cause that was the other thing I had on the instant talk is like, I feel like if you wanted to cause a mass casualty event, you could replace key human leaders and just have them go to war. And sure. There you go. You could decimate half the world's population and you're halfway towards your goal and you didn't have to do any of the work.
Yeah, absolutely. Then the final scene here is William announcing the opening of a new park, Temperance, where Caleb and Maeve are dropped off by the train. He is announcing this inside the park, right? Akin to what Ford would do with his announcements. He would have people out, you know, to sit in the town square or whatever. I think they're up on a rooftop.
That's what it looks like to me.
Area. And this is all happening, as best I can tell, at the exact same time, right? Because he flips on the lights and Temperance fires up and it seems to be connecting the dots on the timeline at least.
Although they could very easily retcon this into being a different, distinct timeline. But to me, it felt like the up on the tower or up on that building is the Delos inner circle, like his shareholders, board members, employees, things like that. And then Maeve and Caleb are the VIP guests that are, you know, not part of that inner circle, but they are there on day one. Mm-hmm. But they could be pulling some weird time shit with us.
Could be.
I thought it was interesting, William's speech about, you know, the 150 years ago, referring to World War One and the Spanish flu and how the world came roaring back. Like it's, you know, not for nothing. That's very closely models the, you know, a smaller scale, what we've gone through since 2020.
Yeah.
Is there anything to that? Is this I wonder how much of this was intended all the whole time by Nolan and Joy, if any of their creative thoughts have been influenced by, you know, what we've gone through in the last few years, because it's felt like very much intentionally bringing 2020 through 2022 into the narrative.
I don't know, man, when you're talking about a world that's about to experience mass extinction events, potentially, it's both there and not there, right? Like a million people dying in the US is not what I would call a mass extinction event. It's barely one of those early blips on the Rehoboam radar. So
it's not a decimation like they're talking in the early 20th century for sure.
Right. So I don't know. I'm sure what human on this planet has not been thinking about that and sort of adopting it into the thought process in the last 2 years. The other interesting thing, I guess, about this simultaneous perhaps opening is this possibly puts William in the park with Caleb and Maeve. Is that something they need to be concerned
Absolutely.
About? Is that something he needs to be concerned about?
Absolutely. Goes in both ways. That's what I'm saying. Like, I understand why William would want to bring his enemies here to kill them. I have no fucking clue why Maeve and Caleb are just going to walk into this lion's den knowing nothing. They didn't even know this thing existed until they set foot into it. And they're like, well, fuck it. Let's just see what happens. Like, sure. You're in an environment that's completely under the control of this other guy. And, you know, you got Aaron Paul and a lady that's struggling to control robots. You know, because like Caleb's just a regular old dude, man. He can't even really hold his own against one lady robot, you know, let alone if they got the fucking mountain. They got a mountain robot in there, right. You know. It's going to be a shit show.
How many guns did they bring with them? Because I don't recall them stepping off the train with any guns.
I'm assuming that Maeve has got them strapped all over her inner thighs and small of her back. Because she like oohed and ahed that I need a lot of these. Right? We didn't see that. But like I'm assuming she's but not enough.
No Tommy guns, though.
Not enough. Yeah, she's unless she's got that. There's some cavernous space within the host body. She's prison pocketing it.
Yeah, it's like Bender. It just a flap opens up on her torso and she stores whatever she wants in there.
She's just shove it up there. I don't know. Or she's doing like, what? Didn't Wonder Woman sneak a sword into a party in one of those movies and like the blade of the sword was clenched in her butt cheeks or something?
Sure.
Like maybe
sure.
She's doing that. She's got the Tommy gun barrel just like in a vice grip. I don't know, because again, however many guns they brought in on their physical person is not going to be enough to handle every host on a rampage. Like if William wants them dead, they're going to be dead. And that's the question. Does Shaloris want Maeve dead?
Sure seemed like it when they sent a bunch of goons after her to kill her in her.
But was that a serious, like, I get hunt. that is that a serious attempt? Or were those hosts programmed to make it a good show? Because this is very, you know, Princess Leia, you know, they let us go. It's the only way to explain the ease of our escape. Again, if they wanted her dead, like send a whole fucking army, send 30, 40 of those guys, blow the shit up. I mean, you know, make it seem like there's a power surge and, you know, a gas tank left in that. Yeah. If they want him dead, they'd be dead. So if Shaloris was keeping the old man around to talk smack to him, maybe she's like wanting to see all of her old foes and humiliate them.
Could be.
Or maybe she wants to turn Maeve to her side.
Yeah.
Bring her back into the fold.
It's possible. Seems like a tall order, but we'll see. Although Maeve seems pretty fickle, right? She experienced one memory with Dolores and suddenly she changed her entire strategy, her feelings about humanity.
And also, it's a very real chance. There's also a real non-zero chance that Maeve might switch sides if she promised access to her daughter in the Sublime. Sure. That's what she wants. She was ready to betray all of her robot kind last year for that deal.
Yeah.
And I know Serac also had like a button that could, you know, incapacitate her and all that kind of stuff. But she was going for her own, you know, on her own mission. I don't think she especially is campaigning for robot justice. Campaigning. She might be campaigning for it.
Campaigning with champagne. Yeah, I can see her doing that. A couple other things here. I love this jazz version of the Sweetwater theme that they bust out here. If you remember, every time they step off the train and Westworld fired up.
Oh, yeah.
It would be this theme with, you know, a more acoustic, a more Western sound. And this feels definitely like a jazzy sound. And then there's a couple of things that William says in his speech to whoever he's talking to that was interesting. He calls it the past of Delos, a dark but extremely profitable past, specifically referring to the Westworld Park era. Is it possible he's lying about that? Because that doesn't make a lot of sense given, you know, the calculations and stuff that we've done based on how much time people spend there and how much money it costs. Possible he's lying about that to his shareholders?
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's lying to his shareholders, because if he's telling the truth, he'd be like, welcome to my meat factory where we bring humans. We're gonna bring all y'all in. We're going to replace y'all with doppelganger. Like, he is telling I think everything he's saying like is that this is not about profit and loss anymore. This isn't about making money. This isn't about anything other than furthering Shaloris's plan. So, I don't believe anything that he's saying here.
Okay. Yeah, He certainly is lying about something.
And that's also like, it's like one that's like, it's like a bunch of CEO shit. Like, we're not revisiting a past. We're recreating. What the fuck? What was Westworld? It's both, right?
Right.
You know,
what
it's just a bunch of
there?
Yeah, no, it's just, I thought it was a bunch of CEO double talk for something that the shareholders have no idea what they're in for. And it's like, there's three layers to it, because I don't think the common shareholder knew about the Forge stuff. So like, maybe the people in the know think, oh, we're going to get back to like getting the good data on the world leaders for blackmail purposes. And then the shareholder is like, oh, we're going to make a shit ton of money just like we did in Westworld. And then the bottom layer is we're all going to be replaced by machines.
And the final thing he says is about that I found interesting and meaningful in ways that maybe the previous statements weren't. He says it was about 150 years ago, and he's referring to what I think is World War I and the Spanish flu. It definitely places what's happening in a time period, right? Like, this is what we think of as current day Westworld. Because that would place it around like 2060. 2070, somewhere in there.
What's the time? So what's the timeline again?
He said it's been about 150 years since the events that he's describing happened with the war and the
Yeah, so 150 years since like 1919, 1920.
Right. Unless he's lying about that, which I don't know why he would, that places this scene at least firmly in the current Westworld.
Yeah, I consulted the official Westworld time. Well, it's not official, but it's on the wiki. And the season one events take place roughly 2052, which means we are 8 years, maybe 9 years past that. So we're in like the 2060s. I think that lines up pretty neatly.
Yeah. When you say about 150 years, there's a decade's wiggle room there for sure.
Sure, sure.
All right. Yeah, so that was a little nice to get grounded there in the time. Like I said, unless he's lying about that, which why would he? But I think that's about it, unless you have more to say.
No, not now. We will have a feedback episode out later this week. If you'd like to contribute that, westworld@baldmove.com. If you got something to say, we'll also probably have some more updates and news and new theories. But it's mostly for you guys to take the stage and give us your best shot, your best useful predictive theories about what the hell is going on. Any things you noticed in the margins, any evidence about loops and the natures of realities, westworld@baldmove.com will entertain all that later this week, probably out Thursday evening, I would suspect. And that will do it for another week of Westworld. Don't forget, every Sunday night, just a few minutes after the episode premieres, Jim and I take to our mics on a live video show. It's exclusively for club members. We released the first part for everybody, but if you want to get in there and actually chat with us and ask questions and contribute, you got to be a club member at support.baldmove.com to do that. So we will see you later Sunday night, and we'll be back Tuesday for all new episode of our main Westworld podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.